This message, titled A Divided Marriage, from 2 Samuel chapter 6, verses 20 through 23, was preached at Winchester Reformed Presbyterian Church in Winchester, Kansas. For more information, visit us at winchesterrp.com. Brothers and sisters, one of the growing tensions in David's life that has been untouched by us so far in these months considering his life, one of the tensions of his life really is his married life. If you remember some of the relationships that David has entered into, you may remember his history. In 1 Samuel chapter 18, King Saul gives to David his daughter Michal to be his wife. We read there in 1 Samuel 18 that Michal loved David. But if you remember the trajectory of their marriage, as hostilities grew between Saul and David, in a fairly wicked scheme, Saul took David's wife, Michal, and in 1 Samuel 25, verse 44, gave her to another man, to Palti. And if you remember, a couple of weeks ago, as we read 2 Samuel 3, David goes to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, and demands that if they are to have a relationship, then Ishbosheth needed to return to him his former wife, Michal, though they'd likely been separated for well over 10 years. And we read there that Ishbosheth honors that Michal comes back to David, her husband, and there we have one of David's marital relationships. But if you remember his history, you likely know that David not only had one wife, David had more wives. In 1 Samuel 25, 39, as we saw some time ago, David takes to himself the widow of Nabal, Abigail. He marries her. Though she is a woman of wisdom, he takes him to herself and they are wed. In 1 Samuel 25, verse 43, David, we are told, also marries Ahinoam. And then in 2 Samuel chapter 3, the divine historian adds for us a number of other wives that David takes to himself, Maach, Haggith, Abital, and Eglah. And if you begin to add them up, as we come to 2 Samuel chapter 6, David has 7 wives. And of course, as we think about that, we need to understand that there is, in the biography of David, there really is a growing tension. And it is a growing tension because David, despite being a man after God's own heart, is sinning in taking these women to be his wives. David is living in rebellion of the divine law of God in these polygamous relationships. Biblically speaking, polygamy began in Genesis chapter 4. It began when Lamech took to himself 2 wives. Lamech, who was of the line of Cain and not the line of promise. And one of the sinful marks of so many, even of our Old Testament heroes and patriarchs, is that they took to themselves multiple wives. And that is, brothers and sisters, it is against the command of God. It's against the design of God for the marital relationship. Jesus in Matthew chapter 19 clearly affirms what God's design is. A man shall leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two shall become one. God's design for marriage is not polygamy. It is the uniting together of one man and one woman in the bonds of covenant love. And so as we begin to see this pattern in David's life, as we see this sinful pattern in David's life, in many ways we should expect that this polygamous arrangement is going to cause trouble. And that's exactly what we really begin to see very clearly here in 2 Samuel chapter 6, that indeed David's marital relationships cause him trouble. And here the problem really is division. It is division between David and his wife, Michal. They are, as we have seen in the words that we have read, they are in a very
divided marriage. And this evening, I want to take that as our theme and endeavor as I can to preach not only for our understanding of this text, but also to derive some spiritual benefit from this history. And so as we walk through these words, I want to look at them under 4 points. And first, very simply, from these words, I want you to note at the very beginning a desire, a desire. Now, if you remember again where and what has happened to David recently, you might remember that the first part of this chapter focuses and emphasizes the return of the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. David has brought it down, that Ark of the Covenant, which is the sign of God's presence, the sign of his blessing to his people, and David secures it, and he brings it into Jerusalem. And as he brings it into Jerusalem, we read that David, in verse 17, they brought in the Ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And then look at verse 18. And when David had finished offering the burnt offerings and the peace offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts. So David is doing here what a king does. Whereas Saul had again and again brought God's curse upon the people, David here offers these burnt offerings. When they are offered up, he turns to bless the people. And then I want you to note what David's desire is as he returns home. We read in verse 19, all the people departed, each to his house. And then in verse 20, and David returned to bless his house. David, having had this tremendous spiritual experience, having brought the ark back to Jerusalem in national celebration of the deliverance of God, in offering these sacrifices, these burnt offerings, these peace offerings, David now returns home in verse 20 with the desire to bless his household. And we need to be careful this evening to understand exactly what that means. And we need to be careful because oftentimes in our own context, in the 21st century, we think of blessing perhaps only in terms of, well, basically synonymous with wishing someone well. That's how we tend to frame this idea of blessing someone. I'm going to bless you, and by I'm just going to wish you well. I'm going to give you some sympathies here, and I'm going to speak pleasant words to you. But biblically understood, what David is doing here is significant. Because in the biblical context, to bless someone is far more significant than just wishing them well. Biblically speaking, to bless someone, brothers and sisters, is to invoke God's favor toward them. To invoke, you might say, the very light of God's countenance, to be a blessing to someone else, whether those are invoking the blessing of God for temporal things or spiritual and eternal things, that really is the weight of what it means to bless someone. That's how David returns to his house. He returns to his house with the desire to invoke God's blessing upon the whole of his household. And we're not told exactly how that is done. If you're familiar with the Old Testament, you know perhaps that one of the things that the priests did after the sacrifices were offered, they would turn toward the people, they would lift their hands, they'd speak that ironic blessing from Numbers chapter 6, the Lord bless you and keep you, the Lord make his face to shine upon you, the Lord lift up his countenance toward you and give you peace. You might be familiar that Jesus, just before he ascends into heaven, raises his hands and he blesses his disciples. We're not specifically told how David desired to bless his household, though it seems apparent that it's likely by means of prayer. praying for the blessing of his household. In many ways, that's what David had done with the people of Israel in verses before. Here he is in his household, and he is going to be one who prays and in praying invokes the blessing of God on his family. It likely included in some measure speaking encouragement and exhortation to his house. Because brothers and sisters, and maybe directing myself particularly to my brothers this evening, that's what fathers do. Fathers are to be a means of speaking spiritual encouragement and exhortation to their households. We've noted it before, but this is the way that the Apostle Paul characterizes his ministry to the Thessalonians. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, the Apostle Paul says, "You know how like a father is with his children. We exhorted each one of you and encouraged you and charged you to walk in a manner worthy of the Lord." And this, friends, is David's desire. He returns to his home, he returns to his household, and he wants to invoke the favor of God upon his household. And there is perhaps just such a simple lesson there for us this evening, especially for men, for husbands, for fathers, for you young men who one day, if God is willing, will fulfill the role of a husband and a father. Maybe the simple lesson in the very example of David here is simply this: that as the men in our household, we are intended, brothers, to be a means of blessing our families. That we are intended to invoke the favor of God upon our households. To be to our wives and to our children a means of spiritual encouragement. To exhort and to charge those within the sphere of our responsibility to know God and to love God and to walk in a manner that is worthy of him. You know, every time I think about this, I think of the illustration of that well-known Scottish missionary, John Patton, who went on to write his own autobiography, one of the most moving autobiographies I've ever read. And if you're familiar at all with John Patton, you might know that he was a missionary from the Church of Scotland. And he was called to go and minister to the cannibals of the New Hebrides. And in his autobiography, he writes of the impact that his father had on him. He writes of the impact that his father's prayers had for his life and ministry decades after his own father had died. And there's one particular section in his autobiography where John has decided that he's going to become a missionary and he's leaving home. He's uncertain of when he will ever see his family again. And he writes in his autobiography of how it is that his father accompanied him on the 6-mile walk to wherever it was that Patton was going to be picked up and then sent around the world for the sake of missions. And he writes about how he walked those 6 miles with his father. His father said very few words to him. But the entire 6 miles, his father's lips were moving and he was silently uttering something. And John Patton realized his father was praying for him. The entire 6 miles, his father was praying for him. And as they came to their destination, and his father was now called upon to say goodbye to his son, uncertain of when he would ever see him again, he hugged his son, and John writes in his autobiography, with tears in his eyes, here were his parting words: "God bless you, my son. Your father's God prosper you and keep you from all evil." And Patton writes that 40 years later, as he had gone and ministered to the cannibals in New Hebrides, as he had entered into a non-Christian place of tremendous hostility, he spent a night in a tree once because cannibals were hunting him. He says, "My father's unspoken prayers ministered more to me in the dark, lonely depressing moments of my life. Why? Because his father had the desire to bless him. And that's what David does. He returns to his home to bless his house. So that's the first thing we see here is David's desire. But secondly, this evening, we see a despising. Here David has a great desire. He has a really good desire, a good intention. But what happens? Well, we're immediately, in some ways here, we're introduced to a significant tension. Now, if we go back to verse 16 for a moment, here's what we read from the inspired historian. In verse 16, we read, "As the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord." And how does verse 16 end? It ends by saying, "And she despised him in her heart." She saw David, her husband, celebrating before the Lord, and her instinctive response is to despise David in her heart. The word there literally means she looks down on him. Here he is, abounding in the joy and the fear of God. She looks upon it as a contemptible state. She detests him and she despises him for what he is doing. And then we come to verse 20 and we read, "And David returned to bless his household." And then notice the emphatic, even contrastive force, but Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, "How the king of Israel honored himself today." There's a biting cynicism in those words. How the king of Israel honored himself today, uncovering himself today before the eyes of his servants, female servants, as one of the vulgar fellows shamelessly uncovers himself. There's a lot of speculation as to what exactly that means. Some people have drawn the conclusion that David was completely unclothed in the moment. That's not really the indication that the text gives. The key here is that David appears like a vulgar person, meaning they're a common person. David, in dancing before the Lord and in celebrating his providences and his mercy and his judgments, the picture actually is he takes off his royal robes. He lays them down in order to be in appearance like the others that are around him. He takes off the royal robes. He appears in this inferior position, this low state of society, celebrating with those that are around him. And Michal comes and she despises him for this. She despises David for the display of humility that he has in the presence of God. She despises him for his celebration and his rejoicing in the goodness of who God is. She looks down on him. And brothers and sisters, we need to understand, even though this is written as plain, bare fact, that this is crushing. David's desire, he comes home wanting to bless his family and he meets Michal. His desire is met with her despising. His godliness as he walks through the door to his home is met with the ungodliness of his wife. And she despises him and holds him in contempt. You know, Michal, in 1 Samuel 18, we are told, loved David. She no doubt loved David as a mighty warrior. But Michal had no idea what it was to love David for his piety. She had no clue what it was to love David for his godliness and the holy affections of his heart and his life as he was consumed with a love for God. And she looks down on him for it. And brothers and sisters, this is a tragedy of epic proportions. It is a tragedy because, friends, marriage is intended not only for the happiness of man, marriage is intended for our holiness. And Michael is doing nothing in this moment to promote the holiness of David. Michael is doing nothing in this moment to promote the desire of David to bless his household. But it's like he meets with this stop sign. How could you do that, David? How could you do that in the presence of other people? She's not working for his holiness. She is working against it. And we see here, brothers and sisters, once again, in this inspired history, we see such a simple, plain, but potent warning. A warning that ought to sound in the hearts of all, and especially our young people and those who are single in the church. Here's the warning. It matters who you marry. It matters. This is why in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul warns us, doesn't he? In 2 Corinthians chapter 6, Paul says, don't be unequally yoked with unbelievers. You know, it's an interesting, almost, if it wasn't so serious, almost a comical picture. What does it mean to be unequally yoked? Well, the imagery that Paul is likely thinking of there, he's likely thinking of this somewhat strange law of the Old Testament. In Deuteronomy chapter 22, verse 10, one of the laws that Moses gave to the people of Israel is that they were not to yoke together an ox and a donkey. And Moses says, don't do it, because an ox and a donkey are unequally yoked. You can't plow the field. You can't be productive. You can't do the very thing that is supposed to be done through the yoking. And in a very real sense, that's exactly what Paul is saying. You can't be yoked together with an unbeliever. You can't. It's like trying to get an ox and a donkey to work together. And Paul goes on in 2 Corinthians 6 to say, don't be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. Why? Because, friends, there is a world of difference between a believer and an unbeliever. There's a world of difference. Paul goes on to say, what fellowship? What fellowship can righteousness have with lawlessness? What fellowship can light have with darkness? What fellowship can a believer have with an unbeliever? And David had married Michal, and he's bound to her by covenant obligations. He can't put her away. But we see here the tragedy of an unequally yoked marriage. It leads brothers and sisters into a world of trouble. David learns perhaps that nugget of wisdom that Solomon will later pass on in Proverbs 27:15. Like continual dripping on a rainy day is a quarrelsome wife. And here his quarrelsome wife challenges his godliness. Challenges his piety, challenges his expressions of devotion and love to God, seeking to stir up trouble and an argument. How right the prophet Amos was when he said, can two walk together except they be agreed? And here Michael despises the desire and the godliness of David. Well, the third thing then we see in this text, as this scene unfolds, we see David's desire, we see Michael's despising, then thirdly, we see David's defense. How does David respond? I almost wonder this evening, and it's a bit speculative, but how do you think you would respond? How do you think you'd respond if you walk into your home and you're seeking to do spiritual good and your spouse or your child or maybe even a friend just tries to stop you and you're like, come on, what are you doing? You're embarrassing yourself. Look how ridiculous you look doing these things. I sometimes wonder, how would I respond? Sheepishly? Almost embarrassed? Would you feel the need to suddenly apologize? I'm sorry, I apologize. I probably shouldn't have been doing that. Well, never mind how we respond. How is it that David responds? Well, David's response is quite fascinating and full. In verse 21, we read, "And David said to Michael, 'It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord, and I will celebrate before the Lord.'" There are really two things that are emphasized in what you might call David's defense, right? He's not going to take this. She despises him, and he comes and he offers a particular defense for himself. And that defense really has two parts. The first part, and it's the emphasis of David's words, is that which he does before the Lord. He doesn't do it before Michael. He doesn't do it for Michael. Right in verse 21, "And David said to Michael, 'It was before the Lord.'" And as if that's not enough, he ends verse 21, "And I will celebrate before the Lord." David is saying, "What I do in the presence of God. What I do, I don't do for your applause. I don't do for your approbation. I don't do to make you feel good about yourself. All that I do in the presence of God Himself. That's what I'm doing. That's what David is appealing to, that I'm doing these things before the Lord." And there's so much value in that. Brothers and sisters, how do we overcome the opinions of men? When godliness is confronted by ungodliness, and the world comes against us, despising us for who we are and what we do, despising the Christian ethic, how do we overcome the despising opinions of men? Well, David demonstrates here exactly how we do that. We remind ourselves and we remind others that we live in the presence of God Himself. And because we live in the presence of God Himself, we live for God. Whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. And isn't this one of the very principles that Paul latches onto in Romans chapter 14? In Romans chapter 14, as Paul is navigating a different situation than David finds himself in here, he's navigating having weak brothers and strong brothers present in the church. Paul teaches this very thing that David expresses in a different context. And Paul says, "Who are you to judge the servant of another? It is before his own master that a servant stands or falls." And that, in this context, is what David is saying. He's saying, even to his wife, "I don't stand or fall before you. I stand or fall before the Lord Himself. What I do in His presence." And when we begin to live in that kind of a mindset and that kind of a spiritual understanding, it eclipses, it overwhelms, it overthrows the opinions of this world. I am not a servant to this world. I am not a servant to my spouse in one sense. I am not a servant to friends and to who it may be. I belong to the Lord. And so all that I do for Him. Even if that means that I will bear the despising contempt of others for the things that I will do, yet will I do them because I live in His presence. There's an old Latin expression, coram Deo, which means before the face of God. It's often been used as a motto of many Christians to say that's where we live our lives, before the face of God and no others. And in a real sense, that's how David defends himself. But that's not the only way that David defends himself here. Not only by this statement that what he does before the Lord. But I'd also note this evening in his response to his own wife that David doesn't understand that what he's doing here is some kind of mindless, strange, mystical, esoteric experience. As if David thinks, well, you know, whatever I do, I can just do in front of the Lord and I can do whatever I want. There's not a mindlessness here, but David also gives his wife a reason why he's doing what he does. Look at how David says this in verse 21. "And David said to Michael, 'It was before the Lord.'" And then notice what he says. who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me as a prince over Israel, the people of the Lord, and I will celebrate before the Lord." Those had to be words with teeth. They had to be a little hard for Michael to hear. The reason that David gives why he will celebrate before the Lord is why? Because the Lord chose me. And he says he didn't choose your father Saul. He didn't choose your father Saul, but he has chose me above your father and above all his house. There's so much here, but let me just say this. What is the reason that David gives to his wife for why it is that he does what he does? Because God chose him. God selected him. God elected him to be the king. And this is the reason, this is the basis of all of his joy and of all of his celebration. And there is a picture in that for us, brothers and sisters. There is a picture in that. Because in a very real sense, what David says here about his kingship is similar to the way in which the scriptures instruct us. This is the way salvation works. Ephesians chapter 1, you can't argue with the word of the Apostle Paul. He chose us in him before the foundation of the world. He has chosen us in Christ before the foundation of the world. Above all others, God has chosen his people. He has chosen to exalt us and to place us in a position that is far above the nations of this world. And David is saying, here, Michael, is the reason for my joy. Here is the reason for my celebrating. Here is the reason for my worshiping. The reason is because of God's free choosing grace. And to that I am indebted. I am not indebted to your opinions. I am not indebted to what you think needs to be done. I am indebted to the free choosing grace of God. And it's really a tremendous defense. How do you argue against that? And as David says that, he comes in verse 22 to say those words that many of us have come to associate with David. "I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abased in your eyes." David is saying, I will be humbled even more than this. You may despise me, and you can go on despising me, and I can be abased in your eyes. And David is saying, it is no matter to me. And then he says, "But by the female servants of whom you have spoken, by them I shall be held in honor." And one of the remarkable things here, brothers and sisters, is it's not only those female servants who held David in honor, it is the church through all history who has 100,000 and 100,000 times read this passage and seen the piety and the devotion and the worship of David and seen it as something that is valuable. He is honored in the eyes of all. Because he is one who before the face of God himself praises the Lord. Whatever else the world may say regarding the Christian and our worship and our celebration of God, regarding it as stupid and as foolish, how we ought to imbibe the very spirit of David, we shall be abased even more in your eyes. So we have his defense. Finally, this evening, in just a couple of words, we have David's desire, we have Michael's despising, we have David's defense, and finally, we have Michael's discipline. Michael's discipline. In verse 23, "And Michael, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death." It's interesting, isn't it? Verse 20 opens with a word of blessing. David returned to bless his household. This scene closes in verse 23 with a word of cursing. Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. What we have here, very simply, is a discipline from God. Michal mocked a servant of the Lord. In her heart, she despised his expressions of piety. And God disciplines her. And the discipline is barrenness. Now, not every barren woman is bearing the discipline of God. Jesus teaches us in John 9 that hard providences fall upon people. Remember in John chapter 9, why is this man born blind? Did he sin? Did his parents sin? And Jesus says, well, neither. You're asking the wrong question. It's so that the glory of God may be evident in this man's life. Not every hard providence is discipline from God. But what we are told in the 23rd verse, in the context of all of this, is that Michal's barrenness is punishment from God. That here we have a sign of God's divine displeasure and God's curse upon her. And it really, isn't it remarkable? Michal refuses to esteem her husband in his godliness. She refuses to promote his holiness the way as a wife she should. And God, in a sovereign act of his own will, closes her womb so that she can bear no child. What is God doing? Because, brothers and sisters, Michal has no interest in living out the obligations of marriage, God takes from her one of the greatest blessings of marriage. Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. What does God say to Adam and Eve? Be fruitful and multiply. Malachi chapter 2, verse 15, the prophet says, has he not made you one with a portion of his spirit? And what is the one God seeking? He is seeking a godly offspring. And here Michal, in despising her husband, in holding his godliness in contempt, is undermining the purpose of marriage. And so God, in an act of divine displeasure, stoops to close her womb, to discipline her, because she refused the obligations of marriage. And it's a warning to us. What is it that the Apostle Peter says? In 1 Peter chapter 3, he tells husbands, you need to live with your wives in an understanding way. Why? Because if you don't, Peter says, your prayers will be hindered. Your prayers will be hindered. And here Michal learns the divine displeasure of God. As she undermines her own marriage, so God, in divine displeasure, closes her womb. It's not a happy ending. It's not a fairy tale ending where all is well. But Michal goes the rest of her life, all the days of her life, to her death as a barren woman because she held David in contempt for his worship and his godliness. And brothers and sisters, maybe one of the big lessons here simply is the tragedy of a divided marriage. Marriage is hard. It is so hard. But bound together in the bonds of covenant love, we are to work for peace and for harmony, for like-mindedness in all things. If God commends the unity of his church, so too, brothers and sisters, does he commend unity in marriage in all things. And here we have this divided marriage between David and Michal standing as an everlasting memorial of how tragic and sad and dangerous a divided marriage is. And yet, by the grace of God, through his continual mercies, his daily renewal, friends, we are called to have marriages that reflect the tremendous relationship between Christ and his church. Let's pray.